Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And if you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a whopping 25% off of your order. That is Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam! Bedlam!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello, and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And guess what? We're your hosts.
We're your hosts.
And nothing has changed on that front. It is still going.
Still your hosts here on the KingCast.
Yeah, believe it or not. But something that is of interest today is we're going to be talking about kind of an obscure title in Stephen King's oeuvre. This is, matter of fact, frankly, this is one that had evaded me. It had slipped under my radar until our guest brought it to my attention. Matter of fact, I thought it was a typo whenever Greg sent over the suggestion. And I'm like, huh, what's that? That couldn't possibly be. I know everything Stephen King has written. But I missed this novella that called Throttle that he co-wrote with his son, Joe Hill. And I read it. I've read it twice now in preparation for this. And I want to prep everybody. If you haven't read it, think of it as Duel and Sons of Anarchy kind of made a baby while Breaking Bad was kind of creepily sitting in the corner watching it happen. That's kind of the feel of this story. Joining us for this conversation is a writer and director who is no stranger to the works of Joe Hill. She adapted Hill's vampire story, Abraham's Boys, last year. Well, probably the year prior to that, but it came out last year. Her latest film is called The Dreadful and stars Sophie Turner. Why did I fumble on that name? That's the easiest name in the world. Sophie Turner, Kit Harington, and Miss Carmody herself, the great Marcia Gay Harden. You can catch Dreadful in theaters February 20th. But first, we're going to talk about Angry Bikers, A Killer Truck, and the art of co-authoring a single narrative. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Natasha Kermani to the KingCast.
Woo! Welcome, Natasha.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming on. And I got your last name right, right?
You did. You nailed it.
Okay, good. Great.
10 out of 10.
As I was reading through the script that I had written, my little intro there, I was like, I normally ask people how to pronounce their name, and I intend to anyway, and then I never do, and that just leaves me open to be super embarrassed on my own show. So,
thank you. You nailed it.
Eric, I just want to say, too, I'm glad you copped to not having read Throttle, because I was in the same boat, and I was just going to pretend like, oh, yeah, I knew this all along, like, you know, fake it till you make it. But what I think is so interesting is that King is so prolific. He works so diligently that there's so much out there, like, that even if you're a super fan and deeply immersed in his world, there's always going to be like, wait, what was this rant? There's like, he did this audiobook only thing, or this comic book only thing, or he wrote this episode of Tales from the Dark Side that, like, there's always some other
a short story that is only available on Zunes in 2006 or something.
Yes. Yeah,
it's one of the coolest things about him, that he just stays working. I think that's really one of the defining elements of him, besides his talent and his voice as a writer, is that he just keeps going. He doesn't stop. You know, he just keeps creating.
He does. And, you know, I am in the midst of preparing a story that will be in Esquire. We're recording this on a Friday. This will run on Monday. I think our podcast will come out after that. So this we're in a little time tunnel here. But I've just done this thing where it's the first excerpt from his Talisman 3 book. Mm. And so I was going back and found an old interview from 1984 that he did jointly with the late Peter Straub.
Yep.
And the journalist was asking him, like, so you work every day? And he's like, yeah, every day. And they're like, he's like, okay, you're so prolific. You generate so many books. Like, how many hours a day do you work? And he's like, 1 to 3. And I was like, wait a minute.
It's just consistent. It's just consistency.
He does it every day. So I was like, I like the 1 to 3 hour work day, Steve. How do I get that? That's not too bad.
One of my first jobs out of college was I directed these little mini docs on authors, and Peter Straub was one of our first. Yeah. So I was like 21 years old interviewing Peter Straub. Very cool memory for sure. But yeah, no, Stephen King is, yeah, he's like the wind-up bunny, you know, that just like keeps going and going and going and going. It's incredible.
Well, and he's also somebody that always embraces new technology, which is not something that you would normally associate, because King gives off like super dad vibes, right? he has bad dad jokes. He's like, when his books get horny, they get horny in like dad ways,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, the most awkward ways imaginable.
Yeah, it's awkward. It's like, you know, Wampler used to call it like, you know, his favorite position's missionary, and he makes you know it. You know, it's like, it's very white bread. And very dad-like, and you, those are usually the people that that struggle with technology. But he, going back to the days when he started on a typewriter, and when, you know, the word processors started coming along, all the authors at the time were like, no, that takes out the artistry and the rhythm of
the
it.
Romance.
And he was clacking away at an 800-pound, you know, thing sitting on his desk, you know.
So true.
It's so weird. So good on him.
Well, Natasha, tell us about your connection to King. We always like to get the Stephen King origin story from our guests, but you also have a connection. Well, as Eric already mentioned, you've worked with Joe Hill on Abraham's Boys, adapting that.
Joe is so amazing.
Very simple,
so lovely
short story. Yeah,
yes,
that's a
very
great,
very
one
simple
of his great short stories.
Yeah, and of course Stephen King was on my radar before Joe. You know, I'm a millennial. I'm in the middle of millennials, so I feel like Stephen King was just in the ether for us. You know, it was like you go to the video store and half the tapes covers are from Stephen King stories, adaptations, and all that. But I think in terms of like really falling in love with his writing, it was Dark Tower for me. I know that this is like probably most of the filmmakers for some reason, we just love Dark Tower, but it was picking up Gunslinger, and a friend of mine got me into it, and I borrowed her copy of Gunslinger and was immediately hooked. And then it became, you know, this journey that he was still publishing, right? Like, I think Dark Tower came out, you know, as I was in college or finishing high school or something. But it was this very long relationship with King and Dark Tower, which, of course, really, like, encompasses his full body of work, honestly. Like, it's kind of, Dark Tower kind of touches all of his creations in some way, however big or small. So it was really Dark Tower for me that...
Yeah.
Opened the door.
It's not a common title, to be honest.
Usually,
really?
Dark Tower on writing. It's usually on writing. Or
oh,
the show.
Really? Interesting.
Or like a Misery, you know, or you know, something like that. I feel like the Dark Tower is like expert level King, right?
Oh, it's like, interesting. Okay.
You know, and I have heard. It's not like that. It's like impenetrable. It's not like you need to take notes. It's not like, you know, diving into a Mark Danielewski, you know, House of Leaves or whatever.
No.
You know, something where you need to study the margins and do some math while
There's
you're reading.
There's a time
it's
and a place for
like
House of Leaves, but it's not. That is not the Dark Tower place. Yeah.
Right. So I'm not saying that it's like necessarily homework or a chore, but it feels like people tend to build up to Dark Tower as Stephen King fans versus, you know, this is the thing that made me fan. I've heard, you know, there have been some folks that have come on the show that said, you know, a similar thing. And I've always been very impressed with them, because that's always, again, to me, that's just like, if you're going to go to that niche weird place that, you know, that the Dark Tower kind of holds in all of our hearts, you know, that's something that I think could easily shake somebody who's maybe just dipping their toe into Stephen King off, you know.
Sure, you know what
bit.
It
Especially
is.
Especially that first book. You know?
Yeah, the first book, is different. You know what I think it is that I was a huge fantasy reader as a child. So, you know, right. Big Narnia, Lord of the Rings, you know, all the classics, Sabriel, like all those fantasy novels was really huge for me as a kid. So, you know, my friend group, my group of core sort of girlfriends and I, we all kind of came together over our collective nerddom of those fantasy novels. And so I think when our first friend who first picked up Gunslinger found it, she was like, oh, great, here's the start of a new thing for us, right? And we all kind of read it together. We pick our favorite characters. Obviously, Eddie is the best. you know, it was a group thing that we could all participate in, like a group of friends reading Lord of the Rings or whatever it might be. Right. So I think that's why it was Dark Tower for us. It was the fantasy route, not the horror route, that brought us to Tower.
Well, one of the things that impresses me about the way he writes The Dark Tower is that he slips into a kind of voice that's very different from the contemporary narrative he does in a third-person story that's set now or whenever mm-hmm. it is in the present day that he's writing. You know, he develops, it's this sort of arcane way of speaking. It's sort mm-hmm. of a high-born way of speaking.
Yeah.
And he does that in, like, his, I don't know if you've ever read his Western, A Death, where it's very spare and it sounds more like the voice of a Jack London than a guy who, you know, who grew up in the back half of the 20th century.
Right.
And I say this as a way of getting into your own work with The Dreadful, because that's a story about women back on the home front of the of the War of the Roses, you know, which is the 1400s.
Yeah.
And I think whenever you see a film set in that time, it either feels like a contemporary film that's just visiting that era, or it has the texture, it has the cadence of something where you feel like, oh no, I feel like I'm actually in a window back to that time. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you are really trying to capture the authenticity, the smokiness of those rooms, the lushness of those fields and forests.
How
in the
freezing
dreadful.
Just the average yeah. day is
real.
Inside of a house. Yeah. With no insulation.
Tell me about finding that voice, a voice right. from that's a medieval tone
yeah.
for your story.
Yeah, we really wanted medieval folklore, right? So again, mm-hmm. like sort of this idea of dark fantasy, and that it is this sort of War of the Roses 15th century world that we're in, but we want to be in a fairy tale version of it. So you feel like you're in an Arthurian, you know, story or something that's kind of, you know, lives in that space. So it still feels authentically connected to that space, but it's not a sort of dry historical day by day. Like, we did take sort of creative license to make it a fairy tale, to make it a folk tale, to give it that sort of dark fantasy feel. So it was sort of always going back to what was authentic and then finding our way through that. So rather than coming, you know, from top down and saying, you know, this is what we want, it's what was it actually, and does that fit the story that we're telling, and sort of how to move this way or that way. So, you know, Sophie's dress is green, for example. That is an authentic green, right? Like, that is a color that they would have been able to manufacture, and we also loved it, right? Like, it also fit really well with the story that we were telling. So it was always, again, starting with the reality and the grounded truth of it, and then giving it that lens of the, again, gothic fantasy horror space, which I think is something that Stephen King does very well. It's always sort of comes from this grounded place.
What are you willing to share about the story itself? Because as I said, it's you've got Sophie Turner and Marcia Gay Harden are women maintaining the homestead as this war is playing out, and their men folk are coming back or not coming back.
Right.
There's a curse. There's a supernatural theme, which is natural because or fits perfectly because in those times, everybody, supernatural was not supernatural. That's just how you perceive the world you didn't understand.
Right.
But how much do you want to say about the story, and what can you share with our listeners about that?
Yeah, totally. Well, I think, you know, I've always loved like a monkey's paw sort of folktale. Mm. And so there's a lot of that sort of element in it. But it's really about a girl woman who is whose world has fundamentally shifted. And she sort of has to make a choice now between which direction she's going to go, who she's going to be pulled towards. You know, the people and the power structure that she's lived with up until this point has just fundamentally shifted. And she has to kind of figure out, you know, which way am I going to go? And so Kit Harington plays a childhood friend who did come back from war, but her husband did not. And so the plot sort of moves from there.
Well, and I also think it's worth noting that Marcia Gay Harden isn't just playing a lady in her life. She's the mother-in-law. So now this poor lady has to live with her mother-in-law, support her mother-in-law.
Yeah.
And she... I will say that there's a lot of times where I see Marcia Gay Harden in things, and I go, wow, they didn't use her to their full potential. It's like seeing Christopher Walken cast in something where he doesn't have a crazy monologue or something, right? And it's just like, I did not feel that way with your film.
Yeah,
I think
Marcia,
you cast Marcia Gay Harden in this role doing the things that she's doing in this movie. You go, all right. Like, yeah. You knew what was up. You knew what her strengths were.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that Marcia's can be very tough, not in a way of being mean, but in a way that she never wants the audience to be taken out of the drama or taken out of what is happening. And so, you know, from these very early conversations, I think she really wanted to understand this character and to not see her necessarily as, you know, a bad person, but to understand where she was coming from and how she was making the choices that she was making and sort of what her system of morality is. And I think that's something Marcia, as we know, can play such a wide range of characters. Mm-hmm. You know, she can play good, bad, evil, everything in between. And it was just so much fun to work with her because, you know, she's obviously a legend. She's worked with some of the best. And so to have her kind of come in and embody this character and bring her own Marcia-ness to it was really, it was just delightful, truly. She was all in.
Can I ask another Marcia Gay Harden question here?
Of course.
Because I spent about a week on the set of The Mist, so I got to watch her work quite a bit there. And I have a photo. They gave me permission. I could take photos. It was a wild time. Like I have this great folder of like behind the scenes pictures from inside there. And one of the photos that I snapped, I didn't even kind of. It was one of those things where I was trying to avoid taking pictures of the actor, like the main actors or whatever. I didn't want to be that guy like making people uncomfortable on set. But I was walking in between takes. I was walking kind of through the store at a certain point, and I looked down the aisle and there was one person there. And it was Marcia sitting in her little like director's chair, but they had the ones that are like lower to the ground.
Uh-huh.
She was sitting in that, and she in Mrs. Carmody dress, and she was reading the Bible. She was just flipping
yes,
through pages
perfect.
Of the Bible.
Perfect.
And yes. I took like a quick, it's blurry. You can't even really tell it's her. But like, I'm like, at this moment, I'm like, she is even in between takes here.
Oh, yeah.
It was probably during one of her early times when she's trying to rouse people and they're not buying it, you know, in one of those scenes. And in between, she's sitting there reading the Bible and
I love that story, and kind of in
character. So
my
question is like, when she's playing a character like she plays in this movie, I'm not saying she's method in the way that like a Daniel Day-Lewis or a Joaquin Phoenix might be a shitty person or whatever in between.
Yeah, not at
but
all.
But she seemed to live in the headspace of even somebody as abhorrent as Miss Carmody. And so what was she like? Did she embody those headspaces?
Marcia is very technical. I think she can drop in and out of the scene very easily. But for example, with this, obviously she has an American accent. And in this film, we actually developed a very specific accent that doesn't actually exist. It's sort of a mix of Old English and Cornish, and it sort of has a bunch of different elements that everybody in the movie uses. So the movie has a very specific dialect, basically. And so she kept the dialect the whole way through, and that was very funny. So, you know, my first phone call, she used her own voice, obviously. Our first Zoom meeting, she used her own voice, obviously. But then from that point forward, every call I would have with her, she'd have like a developing British accent, right? So it would like start somewhere in between, and then it became English, and then it became our accent, which was very cool to sort of hear her working it out technically. But no, honestly, Marcia is like such a mensch. She was out, you know, buying shots for the crew at 2 a.m. in the pub. Like, what an awesome lady.
Ordering using a weird, non-real accent. Yes.
Yes. 20% 15th century sound, 20% Cornish, 20% English. Very cool.
What Eric doesn't realize is, yes, she had the Bible up. She had 50 Shades of Grey tucked behind it.
She was pulling a bit from Back to the Future 2. She had an ooh la la in the middle.
Is that what you're talking about? 50 Shades of Grey? I think she's
in
that.
I don't know. Maybe.
I think she is, actually.
I never saw it. I never saw it either,
but I think she's...
I don't even know if that timeline corresponds. When did that book come out? I just was trying to think of the dirtiest
maybe, like,
book.
Yeah, like you subliminally knew that she was researching her next role on The Mist. Yeah.
Well, speaking of timelines, this is an interesting segue, I think, into Throttle, which is the title that you brought to us here. Because I was looking this up. The original publication of this was in a Richard Matheson tribute collection in 2008, I believe, or 2009, I think. And then it was republished in Joe Hill's Full Throttle. And I was, when I was, you know, reading the story, I was like, I know King loves Sons of Anarchy so much to the point where they ended up casting him in the show.
As the
and
fixer,
I'm like, oh, I
Bachman.
Wonder if that had.
I do kind of love that show.
He played he played a fixer who has to dispose of a body in a
that's
basement.
That's right. And I think his name was Bachman. All that happened was because he, you know, he kept tweeting about how much or writing about the show and all the stuff. And, you know, he's always that way with the stuff he likes. He'll go and evangelize. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, oh, when I saw the original publication date, I'm like, surely that was predates Sons of Anarchy. Guess what? It doesn't. Sons of Anarchy came out in 2008.
Yeah, it's old as hell. Yeah.
Yeah. So he wrote this with Joe Hill in 2009. So I have to imagine he was super into Sons of Anarchy, and that was on both of their minds when they came to
the father and the son, and yeah, right. This sort of the energy of the son feels very Jaxy, and yeah. Hmm.
So Natasha, do you want to do a quick like rundown of the plot for people who maybe don't know? I know I'm putting you on the spot here. So.
Yeah, I can give it a try. So I loved your sort of melange of the, you know, duel for sure, right. Little bit of Sons of Anarchy, and yes, Breaking Bad. So the story follows a small-ish biker gang who is led by an older gentleman who is a Vietnam vet, and his son has recently rejoined the gang. And they are basically riding away from a bloodbath, so like a deal gone wrong in which two people were killed, including a young woman who's like 17 years old. And so they're kind of in their feels about it, and he's not quite sure if they've done the right thing. And as they're sort of discussing it, they are sitting in a parking lot and overheard by a truck driver. As the gang kind of gets back onto the road, you know, our main guy sort of realizes that the truck is hanging around in unusual ways. And then, of course, it sort of evolves into this very dual scenario where the truck is riding down the gang members. And he has to kind of outsmart the truck, basically, to save his son's life. But the resolution is not a happy resolution. It ends up the father and son sort of go their separate ways at the end of the story, after this sort of incredible revelation that the truck driver was in fact the father of the girl who was killed in the event,
and so. Learns of it by overhearing these bikers talking about killing this meth addicted 17-year-old,
right?
You know?
And that's the Breaking Bad is the world is very sort of like this very grungy meth New Mexico. I think they're actually in Arizona, but it's the same idea,
right?
Albuquerque. But yeah, it's to me, I think it's a really fascinating father-son story because it is so from the perspective of the father looking at his son and realizing the, you know, in some ways the mistakes that he made raising his son, but also that his son sort of has this this sort of streak in him that has been there his entire life, and that there's something sort of a little bit rotten in his son that he may have passed down to him, but that is definitely there, and he can't deny this sort of rotten streak in this young man.
it's real interesting to me, this story, because there isn't a let me pull this back. When all the facts are known, the protagonist of the story is the guy driving the truck.
100%.
You know, it's the 100%. Guy that, which is a flip on the Richard Matheson, you know, duel concept.
Yes.
Because you know, to steal a quote from Kill Bill, it's like, you know, these bikers deserve everything they get. They deserve to die. You know, he deserves his revenge.
And that, I think, is very Joe Hill. So I think one thing that you see through Joe's work that is specific to Joe is that he is always flipping the script, right? So he will start a story and you think it's one way, and Abrahams is no exception to this rule with Joe, of he is in some ways reinterpreting his father's generation of storytelling, right? So he's taking Duel, and I don't know if this was Joe, it might have been Stephen, but I think it's Joe, who said, okay, well, what if the truck driver is actually in the right, you know, and we've been with the bad guys the whole time? That's very
I think
Joe
that
Hill.
Is a Joe. That is a Joe I hallmark. Because if that's what he did with the cape, where it's like, what if the superhero is actually a monster?
100%.
Instead of the good guy. Mm-hmm. And I think his dad, Steve, is more of a, he's more of an optimist. You know, he likes
absolutely
when the good guys are good and the bad guys are bad. That doesn't mean he doesn't have shades of morality and decency in mm-hmm. his various characters, but I think he tends to like to dive in. He dives into the complexity, but it's pretty clear who's who.
And, he has a very sort of strict moral outlook on the world, right, where there's good and evil. And so, like, to take Dark Tower, right, like, the Crimson King is the emblem of all that is bad in the universe, right? And, you know, you're kind of working in opposition to that, whereas I think Joe, and maybe this is why Joe's work is a little bit less populist, I guess, popular, because he's very popular, but it's a little bit asking you to be comfortable in the seat of this perceived moral evil, right, or moral right. bad. And that's something I think all of his great work does. Fawn is one of my favorite short stories of Joe Hill's. If you guys haven't read it, definitely check it out. It's sort of a Joe Hill take on Narnia, I'll say that.
Not and it sure follows I have. That same path. Is it, which collection is it in?
It's actually in Full Throttle. So I read Throttle because I was, I wanted to read Fawn. That's how I knew about Throttle.
Great. Well, I'll have to check it out because 20th Century Ghosts is the thing that got me into Joe
Hill. Of course,
Hill.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of like saying, oh, Carrie is the thing that got me into Stephen King. Like, I get it. It's the early work, but, I think that there's a certain talent that you have to have to be a strong short story teller. That's something that King has. It's something that Joe Hill has. But I think the one that got me in 20th Century Ghosts was the story of the ghost that I think it's the title story, right? It's the one that haunts the movie theater.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It kind of hit me going like me and Joe Hill, you know, I think he's a little older than I am, but not by a huge margin. And I think we both grew up like multiplex kids, and the idea of like what happens when you die. You know what, the thing that I sometimes think about, you know, the end times, because I'm not a very spiritual person. I kind of believe that this is our shot while we have it, and do enjoy the time that we have and don't expect anything at the end of it. But like, I do kind of think it's like, you know, as a fan of Fallout, like when I die, I'm going to miss the next Fallout game, mm-hmm. right? When I die, I'm going to really want to see this new movie from this new filmmaker I love. Totally. And so like this, so that spoke to me in a weird way because it's somebody around my generation that probably had the same, you know, thoughts of like, you know, would be, you know, if I was going to haunt anywhere, I'd haunt a, you know, a long standing, you know, going no, you know, never, it's not going to go away anytime soon. Multiplex. So that way you can always be kind of caught up on whatever the latest film
is. And
you know,
I think Joe has that similar thing that we were talking about with Stephen King, where he is also wants to be prolific, right? So don't sacrifice the finished for the sake of the perfect, right? Like if they have an idea, they want to explore it. They want to see what's in there and uncover the creative juices that are underneath it. And I think that's such a great trait to have as a creator, you know, not be so afraid to go and explore. Like, what if I did possess a multiplex? Like, what does that mean, you know? And so there's that lightness to their approach to the work that I think they both share. He has that in common.
Well, it's another KingCast episode, which means it's time once again for me to sing the praises of the show's longest sponsor, Lumi Gummies. Consistent, mellow, and super delicious, Lumi Gummies are specifically designed to make you feel good, not stoned. Whether you're looking for an end-of-the-day distressor, a midday mood boost, or help getting the best sleep ever, Lumi Gummies has a strain that's right for you. Lumi Gummies come in sativa, indica, and hybrid style, so however you want to take the edge off or get a relaxed, creative boost, they have the option for you. And they all taste good, which isn't something you can guarantee with edibles. If you've ever dipped your toe into this area, you know what I'm talking about. And guess what? Your boy is on a human sleep schedule for once, and I can thank Lumi Gummies for helping me get nice and sleepy when the rest of humanity is getting nice and sleepy instead of staying up all night doom scrolling or playing some video game I'm terrible at. The Lumi Gummies have been a godsend in that regard, and it's a wonder, kind of looking around, actually going out when it's light outside. This might be a whole new Vespi you're hearing right now. I'm going to be an early to rise, early to bed kind of person. I don't know, they probably won't stick that way. My circadian rhythm loves to fight against that instinct, but those Lumi Gummies have helped keep me on a straight and narrow schedule more than anything else that I've ever tried, including melatonin. Lumi gummies are available nationwide. Go to lumigummies.com. That's LUMIgummies.com and use the code KINGCAST for 30% off your order. Again, that's LUMIgummies.com, code KINGCAST. Lumi gummies, code KINGCAST. Now let's get back to the show.
I don't want to push you toward talking out of school, but there's something about Joe and his brother Owen King that I find intriguing, is that both of them wrote stories about sons who follow in their father's business. Owen wrote a great novel called Double Feature. I think that was in 2014. And it's about a kid who's a young man who's an indie filmmaker whose father is like a Roger Corman type Saturday night, midnight movie filmmaker. And then you have Abraham's Boys, which you're intimately familiar with, having made the film, which is about Abraham Van Helsing's sons who start to really question whether the dad is on the level or not. And there's, I think, both Joe and Owen, I think, love their dad to pieces, but there is something in every person, probably, but especially in sons, who you grow up and you have to reject the father, right? Like, that's what The Hero with a Thousand Faces is all about, and Star Wars, and Joseph Campbell and all that. Yeah. Do you think Abraham's Boys is in some way about Joe and Owen? Like,
I mean, how can it not be? Having
to break from their dad, you know? Not that they're going to drive a stake into his heart, but like, just say, like, okay, we're doing the same thing, but you're doing it differently. We're doing it differently from the way you did it.
Yeah, and what's so interesting is, you know, Joe and I obviously have had many conversations about this, but I'm always sort of dancing around it, where it's like, well, you know, Zeus replaced Kronos, and you know, it's like, you know, kind of using these big blocks of conversation, and of course he knows what we're talking about, right? Like, it's not me and my dad. It's Stephen King is your fucking dad, and then you choose to be a writer. Like, whoa, you know, that is such a trip, and I love it. It is so insane. I love it so much. And then, you know, of course, both of them are great writers in their own right. So how can he not think of that? I mean, Stephen King is a part of all of our lives. People know the name. He's a legend. That is actually what I think initially excited me the most about Abraham's Boys, when I first read it and I realized, oh, this is the son of Van Helsing. Oh, cool. This is Joe talking about his life and his attitude towards his father, or some an attitude towards his father that he's had at some point in his life. So that was the initial. And then, of course, from there, there's so much more to unpack in that story, and going back to Dracula and the sort of broader themes. But yes, that initial relationship, like, it's an insane thing to try and put yourself in the shoes of, you know, being the offspring of one of the most famous people in the world. I can't imagine.
Like, you're going to hunt vampires and your dad is Van Helsing?
Exactly.
Like, all right.
Yeah.
Oh, you're going to play ball? Your dad is Babe Ruth? Like, okay, like, great.
You know, me, I'm a huge fucking pussy. I'd go be a doctor or something, you know? Like, I'm not going to go up against the king. Like, you know what I mean? Right. But to have that is so cool, and obviously something that Stephen himself, you know, gave to his children. And one thing that Joe does talk about that just sounds so beautiful is, you know, one of their family traditions would be, there would be a typewriter upstairs. I'm sure you guys have heard him tell this story. Maybe not. I don't know if this is a story he tells publicly, but and after dinner, everyone in the family would go up and write a sentence of the story, right? So, you know, and so everybody kind of participates in this storytelling. And so that Stephen King did not hoard that talent for himself, but instead saw it as this a culture, right? His family culture. And so the sons came out of that place of just love of creation and storytelling. And so I think that's really where they're coming from. It's not like oh, I'm going to stick a stake through my dad's heart. Yeah.
No.
It is a family storyteller. Even like Naomi, she didn't go into being an author, but you know, I do know that a lot of Eyes of the Dragon is attributed to what she loved to hear as a girl, and the things that she would throw in, you know, is like, oh, and then maybe this happens next as King was making up a new fantasy story. You know, it's all creativity, and you know, and I'm with you. I'm glad that King fostered that. But it is interesting how we keep talking about what the role of the father is in all this, you know, in all these works. You know, you have the meta version of real life stuff, and you have their works, because King's work is notably impacted by a lack of a father figure.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
It's like he's pretty well known for, you know, for having a lot of single moms and stuff in his work, because mm-hmm. that's what his experience was.
He
never really knew his dad. Mm-hmm. Right. And it is interesting seeing, you know, the work from his sons, where he wasn't that absent father. He might not have been, you know, the best father. You know, a lot of his fiction is him working through a lot of his worst impulses as a father. But, you know, he is somebody who was figuring it out as he was going, because he didn't have that father-dad influence in his life.
And I think that's kind of what that's kind of why Throttle, I kind of threw it out as an idea, because I think it is sort of a unique perspective to have of this father and son sort of using story to objectively look at their relationship and the frailties of that relationship, right? Like, you know, the father does what he needs to do to protect his son. He does his job as a dad. He makes sure that his son is safe. But the moral implications are so much murkier than that, right? You know, I'm a new mom. I have a 4-month-old, and, you know,
congrats.
Thank you. And it is, it's an entirely new identity, right? Like, it's this new complicated web of feelings that you kind of have to process and work through. And so to have this short story that's not just Stephen looking at his son, but his son looking back at Stephen, I don't know. I think there's something kind of juicy there.
For sure.
What I think is interesting about those boys is that they grew up with Stephen King just like we did. You know?
Right.
Like, they had their dad. And then it was like...
Well, poor Joe grew up with his face.
Yeah.
It literally looks like a photocopy of Stephen King.
Owen looks a lot like him too, but he's got more.
You still have a beard on any of the Prodigy, and you're in a time machine.
Yes, 100%.
But you know, my wife went to the American Library Association convention this past year, and she saw Joe Hill speak, and she came back and said it was interesting because he talked a lot about the influence of Steve and Spielberg and how he would watch his movies over and over again. And
huge cinephile. Yeah.
And he also, I think I'm remembering this correctly, is that he admitted that he hasn't read everything his dad wrote, and he works through it. And he had only recently read Pet Sematary, which I was like, wow, that's kind of a long time to wait to read Pet Sematary. That's kind of an early one that most people grab when they're kids. And I think it's interesting to grow up. Stephen King is such a huge presence. I mean, that's why we have this show, because he's such a pop culture touchstone that everybody has some relationship with him. But I think Steve himself has that relationship. There's Steve King, and it's not like he has a split personality, dark half thing going on. He is the guy, he's the writer, he's who he is. But I think even he thinks of Stephen King as being like this role he inhabits.
Yes,
you know?
Of course. And I think that's why the Van Helsing parallel works so well, right? Because there's the public figure, there's the legend, there's the mythology of Stephen King, and then there's the reality of the guy who comes home and has dinner with his family, you know? And those are two different people. 100%. And I think Stephen, I mean, he even talks about this, is that the writing is the writing, right? Like, it's not you. It is the work. And I think that's right, you know? Obviously, you bring yourself into it, but it took on its own entity, right? Stephen King and his work took on its own ethos, its own... It became its own kind of cosmic... entity, and he's just kind of there as the conduit for whatever that is to so many millions of
like
people.
Like the custodian of the dam, right?
That's right. Exactly right. Exactly right. And I think all creators to some degree feel that way, right? But obviously he's on, you know, stratospheric level.
I think evidence of this can be found in his books. Whenever he will occasionally reference something, not as a Easter egg, like, oh, now we're passing through Salem's Lot or something like that, but he will occasionally, I think it's kind of a way of inoculating himself against a little bit of criticism that, like, there might be repetition where he will recognize, oh, there's a haunted car in this, or there's something else, there's a weird ghost story in this, so I'm going to compare it to my other thing just to say, yes, I'm aware I did a haunted car story before. But he always says, it's like that movie It's like that movie Christine. It's like that movie The Shining. It's like that movie Misery. He never says it's like the best-selling book Misery. He always is like, it's like that movie.
Right.
And I'm like,
unless he's in the Dark Tower. Unless you're in Dark Tower mode, then all that's like
literally
the
characters show up and
But he will say, like, he will reference himself, but he never references the books. He references the movies. And I think that's like his way of saying, like, yeah, there's this remove. There's me, and then there's this.
And he loves culture. As you said,
this sort of cosmic custodian of narrative.
He loves culture, and Joe is the same way as well, right? Like, they love, he loves being a part of the fabric of culture and that conversation, right? Like, I don't think it's like, oh, I am the arbiter of possessed car movies, like, or possessed car stories, right? Like, I think it's, I don't know. We went, Joe and myself and some friends went on a vampire tour in New Orleans together. And I just remember glancing over at Joe, and he's just like all in, like just 100% invested in this fucking cheesy ass vampire tour in New Orleans. And I was like, see, that's cool. That's someone who just loves story and the fabric of stories and mythologies. That was a really nice moment, just seeing him just completely encompassed in the story.
He's really embracing it too, as a guy who worked really hard to differentiate himself. I think now that he has, and people see Joe Hill as his own thing, and he's, you know, I hate the Nepo baby phrase. People throw that around. I think it's a really dismissive way to talk about people. But I think he's proven he deserves to be on the bookshelf. And now that he has, he's you know, I'm in the middle of reading King's Sorrow right now.
Nice.
And
yeah, it's great.
Every now and then I'm like, whoa, he's just like full on dropping little Easter eggs
to
the Dead Zone. Like, there's an artifact from the Dead Zone that turns up.
There's a gunslinger, and like, the man in black ran and Arthur followed. Yeah, there's all sorts of. Yeah.
I'm like, he's just like, yeah, fuck it. I'm just going to embrace part of who I am is part of his lineage, and I'm just going to own it, you know? And I like it that he's like, it's like taking his dad's classic car out of the garage and being like, I'm just going to take this to the prom.
Right.
100%. I love it. I think it makes so much sense. And it's so unique to his experience, right? Like, no one else can inhabit that space. So I think it's very cool.
Right. Can we talk a little bit about the co-authorship part of this? You know, because this is always something that I'm intrigued by, you know, because when Steve has come on the show, when he's come on the show, you know, we've talked about like him working with Peter Straub on The Talisman. We've talked about stuff, and I try to get like an understanding of just like what that means as a creative, because you as a filmmaker, you know that even when you write and direct your own things, it ultimately there's a million other voices that contribute to what the final product is. Mm-hmm. But when you're an author, that, you know, having two gods at the table, essentially, you know, that are, you know, omniscient to the characters and, you know that's a little bit of a different thing. And it really intrigues me as, you know, somebody who follows King's work so close enough that we started our own fucking show about it. You know, what it entails when you co-author something. And I've noticed that, you know, with, you know, the stories that I've heard about The Talisman, like, you know, it seemed like Straub was doing his best to do his best Stephen King, and Stephen King was doing his best to do his own Peter Straub. Mm-hmm. And so apparently it became a game between the two about, like,
that's
people
fun.
Going, oh, that's definitely Stephen King in the story. Stephen King scene did this, and Straub would celebrate. He's like, yeah, that's me. You know, I tricked him.
That's
King himself, when he on his last appearance, said that he's a very good mimic, I think, is the way that he talked about, you know, incorporating Peter Straub's voice in Talisman 3.
Sure.
But what's interesting to me is that when you look at the Joe Hill Stephen King collaborations, which we have In the Tall Grass and we have this, and is there something, and there's probably something else I'm forgetting.
There's not a lot. Those are the ones that come to my mind. Yeah.
Yeah, those are the two that I thought, but then I didn't know this fucking Throttle thing existed until about 2 weeks ago. So, but both of those have a very similar kind of feel, whatever that peanut butter and chocolate that is Joe Hill and Stephen King working together.
Yeah.
You know, it creates
not quite
a very
Stephen King. It's a little different.
It isn't.
Yeah.
in even in so much as that, you know, Hill can be a good mimic too. There's some heart-shaped box is a perfect example. That feels like a lost Stephen King novel to me. Like, he could be a, you know, a good mimic as well. Now, Nosferatu feels completely different and feels fully, you know, Joe Hill. Horns feels very much Joe Hill.
Definitely.
You know, so it's like, you know, but I guess the point is that they both have very distinct voices, but are both good mimics. And I look at something, you know, the reason I read Through Throttle a second time was I was trying to kind of trying to figure out, how does this work? Do they, is it an extension of that story you were telling where, you know, one writes a paragraph and the other finishes it? Do they assign different things to each, you know, other? You know, is like, this scene is yours, I'm the next scene. Do they heavily rewrite each other? I don't know what the secret is there, but it does end up giving this very specific feel. And I don't know if you as a creative, you know, have any insight onto, like, you know, what you think is happening there behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any insight into what their process is, but to me, it feels thematically very Joe. Like, it seems to me that it is the relationship between the characters seems like something that Joe might have introduced as you know, obviously they had this Richard Matheson, you know, collection that they were going to be a part of. They decided, okay, we're going to do it. We're going to do Duel. But then that relationship and sort of that, the tension between the characters, the father and the son, to me feels like something that Joe brought to the table. But the a lot of the dialogue to me, the like good old boys thing, like a lot of that feels like Stephen's influence, like the generational difference, right?
Right.
But the idea race, the younger character, does feel very Joe to me as well. So yeah, I mean, to me, it feels like those big broad pillars feel Joe to me, that he may be brought to the table, and then they kind of, but then of course they chose to tell it from the father's perspective, right? So that's got to be Stephen's inner monologue there. So
I think it's cool because Matheson was such an influence on Stephen King as a writer, and Joe has said Spielberg is such an influence on him as a storyteller, and this is like the perfect combination of them because the Duel film is such a man, that holds up so well. It's such powerful, intense movie.
So simple,
movie. A few years ago for Father's Day, you know, I get to pick what we did that day.
Cute.
And I chose, I wanted to watch Duel with the kids.
Yeah.
And then we live north of L.A. in an area that back in the 70s was pretty remote. Now it's the suburbs. But all of Duel was shot up here on these backcountry desert roads. So, like, when I drive to my doctor's office,
you chased your kids?
I go right past where the truck goes off the cliff.
Cool.
There's the little diner that Dennis Weaver stops at that has like the stone facade. That is, it's a Greasy Spoon in the movie, but today it is the fanciest French restaurant out in the middle of nowhere. That's where you go for like your anniversaries and birthday dinners.
So you're kidding. Like, we're gonna watch Duel. That is so crazy.
Then we're going to go to Le Chien and we're going to have a dinner and it's, you're going to see the
place.
You're
going to look at everybody's boots and try to figure out who's the one that's been chasing you around.
Who's the truck driver? Yeah. But it's all right up here. And so I kind of live in Duel land. And but I think that movie itself is quite an accomplishment. Can we talk about that as a filmmaker? Like what your feelings are about the film? And
Simplicity. I mean, don't overcomplicate the issue, you know? That's what I take away from that movie, is just keep it, keep the tension high, keep everything as simple as possible, stay in, you know, understand the perspective that you're telling the story from, and have like really great stunts, you know? It's not to me, that movie is not complicated at all, which is what I love about it. Throttle complicates Duel. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, Duel is the simple version. Duel is the, like, survive the night version. And Throttle, you know, brings all these feelings into it. Complicated feelings into it. Right. But yeah, I mean, look, Spielberg is Spielberg, right? Like, he's the Stephen King of movies, right? He's, we have so much to learn from him. He was working in a time that facilitated his genius, right? So like he was, you know, the film industry, it's always about timing, right? It's talent and timing. And, you know, he was in the right place in the right time with the right talent. And so we get this body of work that we will be pulling from forever. So yeah, we get those every once in a while. And he's so Duel, you can see the beginnings of him starting to work out those techniques and the way he moves the camera. And again, that simplicity of storytelling to bring the audience and keep the tension high is present even with Duel.
It's interesting because you mentioned, you know, the simplicity of Spielberg's direction there. And we talked earlier about Stephen King making sure that the light and the dark sides of his characters are explicitly clear. And it's Joe comes in and is just like, let's stir this up. Let's reprogram it, right? But I like that. That's part of passing the baton, is that he gets to run with it in his own direction.
Right. Well, they set the rules, and then the rules have to be messed around with, you know?
Well, can I also point out that the main character in Duel is a weenie? Right, he is somebody that
he's annoying.
He's annoying. You watch that movie and you realize all this could have been avoided if he didn't antagonize the truck.
Totally.
Right. I don't think that the truck was like, oh, you know, he's Michael Myers now. You found his victim. No. He's just going to chase him down.
It's road rage. Yeah.
It's one small incident. Does he deserve the life threatening results of it? Absolutely not. But he's a weenie. He's one of these guys that's brave in the car, and the second he's confronted with anything in real life, he crumbles. He's not somebody you can root for, which, you know, is interesting. I'm sure that both King and Joe, I don't know why I went King last name and Joe first name, but King and Hill. I'm sure that both authors kind of looked at that when they were wanting to construct their homage to Duel. And the fact that Race, as you were talking about, he's not the main character. I mean, but when you look at it, he's the wrong. He's the one in the wrong. He's the one that went overboard. We find out he has a history of leaving his friends high and dry.
Wow, what a choice. I mean, what a crazy choice. That's 100% Joe Hill.
and you do have that moment that really stuck out to me, where there's a point where everybody else in the biker gang kind of listens, and you know, they pull off in a time where they can get away from the truck, and they're free and clear. They pulled into this town, they've made it, you know, they're gonna be totally good. But whether or not he didn't understand the signal or ignored the signal, the sun continued on. And then they have to have a decision where they're going to chase down the truck and try to save the son. And there's, whenever you have all this stuff where you're getting all these flashbacks, you know, these like little micro flashbacks of moments of, you know, of father and son childhood, the moment that kind of turned against him and soured him, where, you know, the dad makes some, you know, offhanded remark very cruel remark when his kid's, you know, hurting, and the look of fury and pain and stuff in his eyes, and you know, where he's kind of tracing it back to that moment where it's like, you know, that's where I fucked up as a father. But he's remembering all these good times too, of, you know, the little boy that's looking up to him and all this stuff, and all that's building to the point where you see they catch up to the truck and he catches a glimpse of his boy in front of it. Still, he's not run down yet. And there's, you know, there's a moment that happens, I think, right after that, where it's like, well, you got to give him one thing. Like, if he's talented at anything, it's running away.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's such a, like, even in this moment of life and death of this father risking his own life, he pretty much gets to the point where he thinks he's sacrificing himself to save his son by pulling alongside. And they have this like flashbang grenade that they've been little talking boy. About. It's like this homemade flashbang thing. He, you know, he yeets it into the cab. The cab, you know, flashes, and he thinks that in response to that, in order to get there, he has to be next in between the guardrail and the truck.
Right.
So he's like, this is going to be it for me, but I'm going to do this because I have to.
Yeah.
And he does it. He, you know, miraculously survives out of reflex. The driver shifts, you know, turns the wheel the other way. Like, all this stuff happens. But it all culminates into that moment where it's just like, you know, yes, I've done this. And he has this amazing, my favorite part of the story, both times I read it, is whenever the kid kind of reverts to being like a 10-year-old again.
Yeah.
Whenever
yeah.
he's like, holy shit, you got him. Like, oh my God. And you're like, you're my dad. You saved me. And the kid, you know, the adult kid hugs his father.
Yeah.
And his father takes that moment and says, like, you know, knowing that he's about to completely destroy this relationship, because this kid's still fucked up. He essentially murdered, you know, an innocent person.
The kid is bad news. And I think one thing that the story decides to include that I was talking about was that he had abandoned his troops. So he was in Iraq as a soldier and drove away, and so had a dishonorable discharge. Which, you know, whoa, that's a real choice to make, right? For one of your main characters. That's pretty bad.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As we wrap up our conversation here, I would like to draw it back to the dreadful. You know, we're talking about fathers and sons a lot, but you have a story mother and daughter, but a mother-in-law, even a different layer. Tell me about the mother-in-law and the daughter relationship in The Dreadful.
You know, this was not intentional, but I ended up making two movies in a row that were both about parents and children. you know, different settings of them. Obviously, Abraham's is fathers and sons, and this movie is sort of a matriarch who has a codependent relationship on her, on the next generation. So the younger woman, you know, is sort of begrudgingly held in place by this older woman who has this very, she's dependent on her, you know, especially once her son is no longer in the picture. And so for me, it was really, you know, the tension between, you know, the broad strokes was kind of like this idea of establishment sort of leaning on the younger generation, right? So that you have this idea of institution, right? So I'm your mother-in-law. This, you know, within our religious, socio-cultural system, you need to take care of me over yourself, to prioritize me over your own interests. And so that's sort of the broad strokes themes of it, right? And then that's like the very clinical approach of it. And then, of course, we bring the actors in and they bring a humanity to it. And I think what Marcia brought to it was...
An accent.
An accent, for sure. But it's not a sexual attachment, but it is an intimate attachment. And so this intimacy that this older woman feels towards this younger woman is stifling. And I think you can really feel it in the film, especially as she becomes, as Marcia's character unravels and is grasping, more and more grasping at Sophie's character. And Sophie's character is like, let me out, you know, let me go do these other things. That I think was something that Marcia really grounded in a beautiful way. And that, you know, we talked a lot about, especially in those times, that her physical situation is changing. She's an older woman, and it's going to become literally more and more difficult for her to survive without this younger generation. Right. And so that tension and that sort of pressure is part of what is creating the attachment to this younger generation. So it is about this codependency, right, between these two women and what happens as one of them starts to pull away.
Kind of a timeless theme. I know it's set in the 1400s, but that's that push and pull between the generations, I think, is never going to stop. That always
it was,
you know, when Sophie Turner started doing 6'7", I'm like, you know, that's a little too much. You know,
can you imagine?
Of course.
I know. I'm like, I hear it in the ether. I'm old now. I'm a mom now. Okay, I get to. Yeah. I don't have to be cool anymore.
Yeah, my wife's a teacher, so I get to be on the cusp of all the new slang as it's happening. And she also teaches the younger grades, so she knows that she can always call when the trend is ending, when it's hitting the younger kids,
right?
Because then the middle school kids suddenly it's not as cool. So the easiest way to kill a 6'7", by the way, is for the olds like me to start doing it unironically, or the youngins, even the kindergartners for second graders.
That's honestly really good advice. Can we apply that to like other stuff that I don't want happening?
Yes. So when all the kindergartners really get into the alt-right podcast then maybe
cool
the middle
anymore.
Schoolers and high schoolers will be broken from it.
I hope it goes away of 6'7".
Yes. Yes. Yeah. If only. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so do you want to give one final plug to where people can see the movie before things up?
Yep, it'll be in theaters, so you can check your Fandango or whatever it is, wherever you are, to see it in a big movie theater. We put a lot of love into this movie. It's an independent cinema, you know, so support independent cinema. We put a lot of effort into making it an experience that is really beautiful and enjoyable on the big screen. So if you're able to see it that way, that is always the best way to see it. But of course, it'll also be available on VOD and streaming eventually.
Wonderful. Well, great. Natasha, thank you so much for coming on the show. You were a joy to talk to, and I look forward to the next time we can wrangle you to come on.
Perfect.
Thanks very
anytime.
Much, Natasha.
Thank you, guys.
Good luck with the picture. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Many thanks to Natasha Kermani for not only coming on the show, but for picking such an interesting title to talk about. As a reminder, you can see her latest film, The Dreadful, starring Sophie Turner, Kit Harington, and Marsha Gay Harden in theaters February 20th. As usual, if you want to support the show, you can do so by talking us up on social media, sharing with a friend, leaving a 5-star review, 5 stars only. We don't accept anything less than that. Or if you're feeling particularly generous, you can sign up for the KingCast Patreon, where you'll get access to hundreds of episodes that never appeared in the main feed. You also get the ability to partake in the KingCast Discord and be the first to hear new bonus episodes when they drop. Head over to patreon.com/thekingcast and sign up if that sounds good to you. patreon.com/thekingcast. And that should be that. Until next time, adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.